your family last night, your parents party. And I encourage all of you to read the half of January with you in which Bill Justin talks and writes for about 18 pages or so. He's still the body of a lot of the movement. And I want to agree with everything you said in there, in which he deals with the political and economic hard work, hard changes that have to go on for blacks to make any dent whatsoever into a culture that is no longer a democracy. It's a myth. Conspiracy is showing that it's a myth. It's a myth because two cultures can't come together in our society, apparently. An awful lot of the article, he put down Black Manifesto, he put down revolutionary rhetoric, he put down cancer rhetoric, as feeding the guilt feelings of rights, and nothing but change. And he went on to the hard political economic work that we have to go into, work for, in order to get change where we eliminate the double standards that are everywhere in education, jobs, housing, anything you want to know, total double standards, total institutional racism. I agree with you. But let's step aside, pastors, men of God, men who claim the ultimate. You take a good look at that penultimate. He's right. But thank God for the Vanguard Party, or the Panthers, and the Black Manifesto, because you believe that Harper's Magazine would print to the American public, they are rushing hard-hitting political and economic suggestions for equalizing men, if it wasn't for Panther rhetoric and some microphone and some other things, they wouldn't. They're owned by kids. And when I asked the black women about the two pastors, about one of the pastors, and she started the two, I think there better be somebody in the Vanguard Party or pastor. Because apparently everything that I've ever seen in life requires the Vanguard Party. And the Vanguard Party usually loses its life. And somebody else has to come and follow up and try to understand. Another way to say two things in this lighting. I've been trapped in the last 4 months once again. We have a whale of a program in the city. We know all kinds of people, militants, grassroots, community organizations where nobody can go today because you can't go see the people anymore. The day's over. You don't need a curfew of 6 to 6 CT living in Chicago. We got it anyhow. And you laugh, or some people laugh, when I say in 3 years from now I'm going to need an ID card to get into Chicago. I will. I have to have an ID card of why I make a daily trip to Chicago or something like that. That's true. We used to could live there. We used to could tutor there. Then we used to could sort of be in the integrated neighborhood at least. How many signs do we need of what's happening? I heard this morning, sorry, I disagree, faculty member, but I heard this morning that things are getting better with race, problem in America. Well, I was cut by that for a moment this fall. And so, just like the labor movement and our great program in the city, we have fine militants from all sorts of goings on, movement, and everything else for our young students to hear. And quite accidentally, I got two young people who were 12 years old. I knew them real well 2 years ago, and I haven't seen them since in the project. I called them out of the housing project. What it's like being a teenager living in the housing project. And I never listened, incidentally. And I thought, you know, that's what I really want get across. We were discussing housing. And we'd been in the program for 2 months. And for 2.5 hours, not longer, 2.5 hours, I heard black rage. I heard honky this, honky that. I heard all kinds of slogans. I heard emotional stuff, everything. Stuff that I'd get tired of hearing don't like to hear. It's not very rational. And with Fred Hampton's assassination, I imagine there are 100,000 more 12-year-olds in this country that are living in slogans automatically, immediately. But in spite of all the pain of listening to that 3.5 hours of rage by 14-year-olds, the greatest thing that happened to me, because I remembered that black rage is growing, that the welfare rolls are growing, that the city of Chicago, which is the same as St. Louis and black rage there, the problem is worse. There are more people on welfare. There are less doctors in Woodlawn than 10 years ago. We just got an educational report out, the government put out. Well, we didn't need it. Black families didn't need it. Movement people didn't need it. We've been trying to say that. Inner city education in Chicago 5 years ago was substandard on the average of the United States. It still is, but in Chicago it's worse than it was 5 years ago. It's going down. Schools aren't even open anymore. And I've been involved with housing. I happen to know that 235, 236, HUD, low-income housing, that's beautiful stuff, you know. But it has absolutely nothing to do with the poor. Oh, I mean, for people who are not very wealthy, or not middle class, maybe, whatever that means. But I'm talking about the poor. Poor who are in day-to-day survival to exist and haven't got time to reflect. And I'm not talking just about welfare, but I'm talking about the poor and on welfare. In Valparaiso, and I won't dwell on it, but in Valparaiso, we've got 30 families with dough, concern, lots of different motivations. That's not my priority, what the motivation is. Want to make it possible for new families to come in who want to come in now welfare. You do know that it's almost impossible for 30 families, middle class families, a lot of care, a lot of talent, some money. It takes almost 30 families, and then you might not can make it to help one welfare woman with 7 children get out of a housing project that's a concentration camp in our concentration camp. Now, if we can't do it with 30 families, that's the answer. And you know what we're up against. We're up against a society in which church and state are married. They are married. All the public officials are Christians. They are married. Our congregation has the mayor, the bank president, the realtor board president, and the president of the university, and the president of, and the head of the Republican Party in county, and the top contracts in town, and we can't get anything done. You tell me it's different anywhere else. It's not. Alright, well, watch the time, then. Alright, come stand. The question is, I feel guilty being up here, because I think a welfare mother ought to be up here, I think a cancer ought to be up here, a young lord ought to be up here, a young preacher ought to be up here, maybe an Indian, but be careful of the Indian, not him, but be careful what they're going to do to the Indian next. Be careful of people getting up here and talking about pollution. General Electric is pouring money, lots of money, into the political thing to get pollution as an issue, to get the war machine off their back. Be careful. And Indians are safe. It's going to be a big issue soon because they're safe. There are not too many of them. I'd rather not ever say anything, even if anybody asks me what can I do, because I don't know why they would ask me, then that's the thing they would. The reason I don't like to is because we've all been programmed, totally programmed, not to think for ourselves. How can I possibly think for you where you are now, not the same? But I would like to throw out some concerns that need to be thought of. I mentioned the one on the ministry. Somebody better go walk in the streets and not take a job because it's a good gimmick. Take a job because where you are needed with young people in the city, or too, in the city, you better not have a program, you better not have a structure, you better not have all those words. And so who's going to support you? Not district, who's going to support you? So you have to go to work. There's no choice. Now there's a gimmick. You have to go to work. That's one thought you might think of. I know people in the city that need somebody. I have no idea what that somebody should do with these people. I just know they're hungry. They're hungry for the ultimate. They've been through the penultimate. And they're hurting. They've been through Sunday and God is dead. I believe he is dead. That God of Sunday and heaven spirit is dead. But we've been through Monday as a hand-drawn and very optimist and all that crap. That's dead too. Now we're, that was the secular city, you know. Now we're in the theology of hope. We know it's Sunday and Monday probably. Together. Or somebody better be walking around because they're vanguard people, individuals so far, not corporately yet. Individual vanguards have discovered that the theology of hope doesn't deal too well with Friday. If you know what I mean. That's the day of the week, too. And if we could sit in our house, that's a real positive, actually, but really think about it. Because people will not walk into any church that you're going to inherit or that you go to now. Hungry people are not walking into a place. Black people are not going to walk into a place that's dehumanized and castrated them all their lives. That's too frightening to do that. So a new sense of what it means to be a missionary is really in order in this country. A couple of things I've forgotten, just cut me off. Remember two big things about our country right now that I think are so evident. A few out about our daddy's had to work hard and it became a god. There's nothing wrong with working hard. We got a new danger. It's called things for things' sake. Most of you students, not faculty, woke up, and certainly your kids, and I wake up and look out in the world and I don't see a world of total change. Many of them are change, not rigidity. They're not going to look in on themselves and see who works the hardest in terms of working the longest hours or the best mousetrap or something. The new game, idolatry, is who can look out in that world of change and see that the power is the people. And the new game is going to be to justify and prove yourself and being the most constructive changer of society and social things. And don't let that slow anybody down from changing society. Because I got a problem, and it's not a problem, but it's a problem of communication. Any corporate or private identification with the church. And the primary message of the gospel that gives you work, corporately or privately, in what you do or don't do. Social action or no social action, in my terms, is blasphemy. Therefore, let's find a creative tension between these. But point I want to make, what kind of society are we in? We're in a domestic imperialistic society. We've already imperialized the world. Good Lord, let's get off of that. I mean, don't get off of it. Let's know that. Take a good look at our own country, the imperialism in our own country. And to see that we are no longer an efficient economy, capitalism, we're in a waste economy. An example I often use is the pill, sounds funny to say this, it's almost a pun, the pill contact. The fact of the matter is that antihistamine pill called Contact grows 16 million last year. Now, the example I'm using is true for everything in this country. And that's different than our daddy's world. 16 million. In our daddy's time, there were two ingredients to what made up that money. Cost of production and profit, right? Well, you know how much cost the production and profit were for the 16 million growth by the Pearl contract last year? $3 million. $13 million was spent of the 16 to get you to believe that you had to have the Pearl contract. That is a waste economy. And faculty members and pastors here, we students here, know good and well, and especially their kids know good and well, they haven't worked a day in their life. And they look around them and they know that 30 million people in this country are homeless in a sense, and double standards, poverty, let alone what we're doing to the rest of the world. And they cannot drive with a waste economy where the name of the game is that you've got to get rid of last year's car. You're not anything unless you wait. And that's a whole new ballpark, and young people today, faculty and pastors, are revolutionaries whether they know it or not. They're not going to accept it. A economy that wastes when people are starving. They're not going to accept it. And that's a whole new ballpark in our bodies, and somewhere along there we might be finding the way to dialogue, because dialogue is essential. I'd like to, then there's one other and a lot of them, and go on forever, but you and I know that the name of the game in this country is not racism, but don't be tricked with new things like pollution, because it's not that either. The biggest ones are war and race. Hang on to those as the biggest symptoms we've got. But all of them are only symptoms, because we are in the business of
running that
country, and there's no room for that, Beth. And we've got no life. And if you want to really hide it and see where it's really hidden, go to a funeral, you know? And then it's really hidden, but it's hidden at every turn. We hide the poor, we hide the handicapped, we hide the ugly, and our own families, our own communities, our own churches. And, oh Lord, there's so much. What a family is. In this country, a family is the sum total of the number of individuals. What a mockery, and the Lutheran Church is paralyzing Americana on that. A family is more than the sum total of the number of individuals. A family is not a place where you come together and look alike and act alike and cut your hair and get a crew cut and clean up in order to be a member of our family. Then I'll close with a hive. 19-year Illich. He said of my daddy King. Really big that guy. I can't say what he said very well, because it kind of for a research or something like that. You don't have to be political. That's why politically political is not to be political. I've learned that. Ultimately, you better get political, but don't scratch your head. In South America, where the big talk about education, everybody's got to be educated. The hard facts of the matter, with all the alliances for progress, all that junk. Every soul in South America, for the next 400 years at best, is going to get 15 months of education. He says, why not concentrate on what we've got? Why not be creative? Stop thinking in the old pattern. Challenge the state. Forget all that talk about you ought to go to school, out of work, good work, and so forth. We want 16 months of education now. Only we want it maybe grade 8, 1 month, 9, 1 month. So 16 years, 1 month of intensive education, instead of go for the 6-year-old and the 7-year-old and you drop out because you have to go pick in the fields or something. Or, the fact of the matter, for the next 300 years, there's going to be $20 per family for shelter in South America. Can you imagine if our technology went to work and quit fooling around with all this rhetoric and Mexicans and everybody, get rid of them. Just talk about how can we, with $20 per family in South America, and our technology and our know-how, make more out of that. I might add, that'd be the most political thing in fact to do. Because the only reason we don't have housing for people today is because it's politically important not to have housing for people today. When you spend 15% on a car to manufacture it, stop and think. Why do we spend 60% on a house to manufacture it? We can do better and cut housing costs in half. We want to. If you're dealing with black people, minority people, and you're dealing with a system today that insists that people be on the bottom and be kicked and stepped on, it's part of the people.
Agreed to take some questions from the floor. We definitely have the time now. So, we'll throw it open to those of you here who might want to ask questions.
So, to talk a little bit about the conspiracy trial, and if you could expand on it and talk about its significance.
Yeah, I took apology of one really ought to study the conspiracy trial, study the law that they've been tried under. And I can't relate all the facts and how Thurman, I know how he did, but I would pack it up and so forth. The real significance, as far as I'm concerned, is that the myth of democracy is on trial. There are two cultures in that classroom, courtroom, both, you know. Like the Tartoff over there. A nation under law. I'm not good at articulating this, but I feel it very strongly. A democracy must be a country of pluralism, of many cultures living together under law. The moment the law steps in the way, thank goodness we have civil rights, civil liberties. It's the function of civil liberties, as I understand it, and feel it rather, know it that way, to make sure that the law is being exercised in such a way as that democracy does in fact, is in fact not a myth. And the conspiracy trial, the very law that they're being tried under is one of civil liberties. Therefore, we're all at stake here. Two cultures are coming together. And they're being tried under a law which denounces one. You only have to visit that courtroom to know what I'm talking about. And the defendant, incidentally, there is absolutely no question that those that are close to it know that those defendants could all be free today. Had they cut their hair, shaved, put on a tie, and got up and down at the time that recent tradition says they should get up and down, and said yes sir, no sir, and never counted any of the answers. Never laughed, never showed emotion. They would be free today. There is no question about it. Those of us that are fairly close to it. I know four of the defendants quite well. Matter of fact, they're looking for housing right now, so when the trial goes into, the jury goes into testimony, I anticipate 3 or 4 days in which the whole staff, the conspirators, it means they chose for themselves. You see, normally in America, in a country that's been socialized into one culture, you go into the courtroom feeling guilty. And they said, no, let's face it. They didn't. They charged with conspiracy? Yeah, they're conspiracy. But anyhow, the lawyers and their wives, and the conspirators, and their wives, and their children, and the staff, they've all lived together since this trial began. The new lifestyle. I'm changing the subject for a moment on this lifestyle, and I don't want this spread around because politically it's not, shouldn't happen that way. At our congregation, in Justice Land, we have a beautiful, costly $1 million orchestra and so forth, and tremendous financial difficulty. And so we're going to have to curtail enrollment and charge tuition. Next September, there'll be at least 50 students more than the total maximum can possibly hold, and there's no more money in the budget. So a very, very small group of people are meeting, a sound way to group dynamics, all organic way to get expertise and so forth and so forth. But it's our building. The state laws on certification from grades 1 through 8 are not that, they're mostly concerned with facilities. And we're going to propose, after we get all the possible rentals and let our group grow to 50 children and maybe 30 families, then we will propose an easy way out for the dilemma facing charging tuition, shopping out the pool, or something like this. And our school will run from 2 in the afternoon to 7 at night. We have got used to the gym with the families in the evening when it's not being used because the City Park League uses it at 8. And the first teams of the first grade, and the first team of the second grade, and the first team of the third grade, girls and guys all the way up uses it in the afternoon. And we will eat there. We use the cafeteria. The home ec department at the university, we need places to practice in large groups. But anyhow, I'm talking about a new style, a whole new lifestyle. And we won't be going to school quite as much. And incidentally, sixth graders, 30 minutes a day, as it's being worked out by experts, not by me. It's very important because social education and public school education is not conducive to learning today. And sixth graders, 30 minutes a day, on a one-to-one basis, are going to teach things to first graders that I could never teach them. It's going to be wild, you know? Now, I hear all the states answered, the problem of the extra 50 are answered, don't have to charge tuition, any extra money will be covered, everything else. You know, and I know it's going to be a political bombshell. Because we have a hard time allowing more than one culture to exist in our society called democracy. You dig in? And this is what the conspirators are up against. And what they're up against is involved with the process of peace. In a sense. Any questions? Please. A small group of people are meeting. A sound way to group dynamics, all organic way to get expertise and so forth and so forth. But it's our building. The state laws on certification from grades 1 through 8 are not that, they're mostly concerned with facilities. And we're going to propose, after we get all the possible rentals and let our group grow to 50 children and maybe 30 families. And we will propose an easy way out for the dilemma facing charging tuition, shopping out the pool, or something like this. And our school will run from 2 in the afternoon to 7 at night. We have got used to the gym with the families in the evening when it's not being used because the City Park League uses it at 8. And the first teams of the first grade, and the first team of the second grade, and the first team of the third grade, girls and
and go in and you know, just really humbly give himself to people, like, you know, tear the shirt off his back and put a tourniquet on a bleeding, and all this kind of stuff. You can handle all these, and he doesn't say, "Oh, I didn't know that, well, no, I don't care, I don't like him either, I don't like you." And funny thing, when a fellow falls in love, he always thinks that he's got to give an account of why he is in love.
He's the best cook in the world. He's the best swimmer. He's the best looking guy.
No, Buster Williams is a better swimmer. Zaza is better looking. And Pierre the Waldorf is a better cook. And he said, "Well, I don't care." Yeah. And if you stop, let me just study his rationale that he's developed, he's still where he was anyway. And this is the folly of trying to persuade people that they should either, you know, like the Negro or oppose the racist. You don't feel that it's that way. If I may illustrate this a second, let's take a woman who was reared in the South, we'll say, and all her life was emotionally conditioned without ever being taught that black men are a threat to her. Maybe it happened that grandmother said, "Look, are you going to a church meeting on the other side of town? Will you tell the boys not to take you through quote colored town?" My mother says, "We're now coming to that certain part of town. Lock your doors." Right. "Your school is integrated now?" "Yes, it is." "Will be a mixed group of children?" "Oh, yes. Some of the girls are cheerleaders and they're looking like them." "Do I have any boys there?" "Well, they will be if you don't." "Yes." "Will you just be with the girls?" This, the little comment, nobody has said anything about black men being a threat, but somehow or other that thing was instilled just by that kind of conditioning. You know, when aunts and uncles do it over a period of 10 or 12 years, it's pretty strong. Or maybe this girl didn't have that kind of condition. Maybe actually a neighbor here was raped. Or scared and thought she was being raped. Like a black man saying hello to her. Yeah, whatever the cause, there it is. See? Now, years later, when she's married and she has her neighbor woman over to tea and they've got their husbands off to work and their kids are outside playing, she says, "You know, I just don't feel very secure about black people being around black men. I don't mean they're married, but men are, now at that moment, if the woman from next door who said, you know, just got out of it, she says, "You're wrong. This is the, well, D.A.G. Heber released some statistics that showed that the crime rate among black men is much higher proportionately than among whites. Furthermore, did you know that the number of venereal disease cases among blacks is far higher proportionately? Do you know that there are a great many women in Negro communities who do not have husbands, who stay home with them, and they have no children to go down to?" Now, you can come back and counter all her points and talk about the matter of poverty, how they're Christian, the very social findings, psychological findings, et cetera. And then you're all finished. She says, "These are all in here. And it's testimonial." Now, her counterpart is a black man who, all through his childhood, was growing up with uncles and grandfathers and dads saying, "Look, girl, don't you be anywhere near a white girl. Just take my word for it. And if any of them put their face up in your face, and you see them come to your side of the road, you just go on his side. You don't have anything." And without an explanation, what's that white woman being talking to you? You're looking where you go talk to the man. And so, this is a fair thing. By implication, he's learned there's something about this yet. Now, it may not be just this emotional condition. It may have been a real, fantastic, traumatic situation. It happened with a member of my congregation in Oklahoma who had bellhop in a hotel and was carrying an order to a room to Martinez, and when he got there, he found Spike Fleming in the state, invited him to come in and have a cocktail with him. He got out of there fast. But another fellow heard about it, and he went up and she invited him in, and quite unexpectedly, her husband came, and the woman screamed rape, and the man had to get out of town fast. That's enough to do it too. But this man may not name this sort of thing. He might find out the large number of black women who have had babies that came out a lighter time, which meant that a white man had forced them, which meant that the white women weren't providing their white men with enough to keep them home. The white woman who is constantly showing as a picture of virtue, but she ain't all that, and he knows how she's shooting around because he's looking around the yard and sees a lot more than the husband and so on. Now you may point out, look, my friend Nightingale was a woman, you know, and some of the first people that established schools in the South for Negroes were white women who gave up, you know, the opportunity to get married now just to really give themselves. No, let me say different. She is really down on white women and regards each one of them as a witch or worse. Now, let's carry our hypothetical case just a little farther. And on a given day, let's see these two women drinking coffee in a room, and the woman looks out, and she sees that her little boy has just run out in the street. Meanwhile, across the street, the black man is walking. And he sees the child, and a big truck coming, and he pushes the child across the street, and his legs get run over by the truck. Now, this is such a big experience. 2 seconds later, the woman is out on the curb and wiping the blood from his head with the dish towel that she had in her hand, using the grounds in his heart. And anybody would tap her on the shoulder and say, "Sir, don't you know that that man just stepped to you?" And I said, "Away, this man is letting her die. He needs help. Call an ambulance, call a doctor." But he would tap that black man on the shoulder and say, "Hey, don't you know that this woman is a white woman? Listen, I'm hurting and she's giving me some relief their way." Now, you may find in a few weeks that a man is back in a wheelchair, that he's out in front of their house while his family's inside, getting ready to sit down and eat, and he's putting a few weeds and his tomatoes out in the front garden. And meanwhile, the woman has been going over and befriending the mother, and there's a real relationship. Maybe this is the only Negro family that she's, but at least he's turned that corner. And it's not been a matter of reason or rationale, but it's been a traumatic experience. Or it could equally be a series of emotional conditionings large enough to dislodge the previous one. Now, not every exposure to a person of another race is going to have a happy ending. Smelling versus Jolius, you couldn't get much closer, you know. There are certain cases where people are thrown next to each other, and if the competition aspect comes in strong, I think you notice that it can happen among Christians at many levels. But hatred and love, you know, there are even divorces from people who've been very close to each other. But you've got to test the possibilities here of knowing that we have a great deal going for us if we really use this great impact that an emotional traumatic experience can bring, because almost everybody whom we have in the Christian faith, we try to involve not just in a plain old recitation of catechism and Bible passage creeds, but we try to involve them with the Son of God, who, with the Bethlehem and Calvary and resurrection experience, brought some dimension into it that is far beyond the natural and the very logical There's emotion here in the blood and the love and the blessing and the peace. We've got this going for us. And let's use it. And don't try to get people to become lovers of lost people because the Lord said, love thy neighbor, or because the Lord hath made us one blood all the nations of the earth. We're running the trouble because it also says he's appointed unto each their place, you know. Well, I hear people say, yes, but we got to really preach the gospel. I was really kind of sorry. A recent letter to the pastor said, there are, you know, it's possible that people are now saying you've got to bring the gospel through love, and it's got to be preached. And if you don't preach the gospel, it's not going to be, you know, transmitted. Well, I think that's unfortunate to say it, and I think we've got to stop saying it. I don't know. See how the wide, far-out guys in the church. Is it the Niehaus, the Simon, the Herbeck, all these people, the Herbeck, the Perez? Are these the wild-eyed social gospel people? I've gone to their services and I hear them preach, they're teaching Christ crucified very beautifully. And we've got to stop saying this, that this is the big risk. The big risk is that people only talk and never follow it up with a kind of warm love. And these are the things that we have to attend to. Sure, the Lord says, preach the gospel, but when people say that's our first work, that's our main job is to preach the gospel, I think there's something prior that we've forgotten about. To whom does God say, preach the gospel? He says it to people who have been made sons of his. We've got to be faithful to what we are, and it's the nature of a son of God, the son of God, to be loving. And he that knows to do good, he that knows to be consistent with the nature we have. Don't try to divide it. It's all one piece, that we be loving in our actions and loving in our words. I'm concerned that we don't catch the very helpful dichotomy that Joe Stringfellow introduces. And he says, I just don't feel comfortable talking about good and evil. I feel better talking about life and death. And to understand what great opposition our Lord had to death, and how indeed he was affirming life. This makes sense out of the 1 John 3 passage, where we see, you know, he that hates his brother is a murderer. Everybody says, you won't touch me on that. I don't hate anybody. I dislike some people to be saying it, but I know you're going to touch me calling myself a murderer. The idea is that people feel that hatred has to be something passionate. You know, if you've got bloodshot eyes and a furrowed brow, you're just not going to be hateful. When we're talking about this, he that hates his brother is a murderer, we're at the place where we really see the man who is fighting with death, and all he needs is a sandwich. And you, without being angry, you may be going to a church meeting, you may have to do a whole lot of things, but anyway, you don't give him a sandwich and he falls over dead. You don't hate him, you just don't love him. It's not even a case of, you know, it's just opposite. It's having other priorities. And all you're doing is taking bread from him, and that bread is his life. You're taking life. Did I say you were taking someone's life? That's another way of saying murder. The Christian is in the life-giving activity of Jesus Christ. It was a very vital part of Jesus that he gave people more life. The blind people got a few more dimensions of living. The lame people got to move around in that life. And the hungry people got fed, and so on. And the people who were the rejects and had no real life of dignity were restored to dignity with a go and sing no more. The church must recognize where it is not in the life-giving process. The church is too long under the leadership of its pastors been saying, I agree with your goals, but I don't agree with your methods. And so therefore I hold off and I don't help you to reach the goals that you're trying to reach, and in my failure to help, I'm almost assuring that the goals will not be reached. And what I'm really saying is, I'm going to help you not to reach those goals which are really occurring up here. Judge Kelsey, a Jewish theological school, says, the problem with Christian people is that they are always looking for the perfect vehicle. And I can't do this because that's the only reason. When it's something we really want to do, like building a parochial school, we don't wait for 100% vote. If we really want to build a new church, we don't wait for 100% unanimity. We recognize that certain things aren't perfect, but that we go along with it when we really want to do something. And to wait for the perfect vehicle, because well, this isn't quite right, you know, making certain mistakes. And by paying attention to that particular little thing, we keep from doing what God wants done. And I suggest you look again at this matter of Christ's disciples and the Sabbath. If Christ has a claim in your life that you gladly surrendered to him, then every poor, hungry, lonely, homeless, cold, thirsty, or imprisoned person has a claim on you. Not just to give him words, but the work, the whole work, the wholesome work of life-giving, feeding, sheltering, befriending, welcoming, giving the word of love, giving the word of forgiveness, giving the word of reception into the kingdom of God, where God rules in our hearts and the hearts of the brother. And we have to see our white brothers to stop being afraid. See not only the white brothers, but the whitened brothers. The black people whom we sort of made to be like us, to think like us. The Lord said, the more you are like us, the more you qualify, the more we'll accept you. I would hope that we who have so often said, we've got to do things together. We're going to send a missionary to India, we've got to be together. By joining in the churches, we support one another in doing something we can't do alone, but somehow or other, pastors have always said, if you want to support the government, then you go out and do it alone as a citizen. George Kelsey has a word to say about government, too. Government is a ministry of God. Its job is to protect the innocent and safeguard those who are righteous, civilly righteous, and to curb and to punish those that are evil. And you know what you do with an unfaithful ministry of the gospel. Do this wrong and one little thing like saying if you don't support our English Mitchell supper this week, you're going to be under church discipline. Now, if he does everything else right, we'll go along and we just say, hey, Pastor, we're not going to go to that supper. We'll show you that's wrong. But we'll keep working with you. You don't quit the church just because it says, you know, any baptizer and give communion, this is fine, see? It's this infidelity, this pure conduct of his ministry, this unfaithful ministry of his. That aspect, we deal with it. Sure, we want government to slow down people to 15 miles an hour when our kids are going to that school. But when government is unfaithful, when its police are brutal, when policemen become prosecutors, juries, and executioners, and are given dum-dum bullets, then the Christian, and the Christian corporately, who is in touch with God because we have his revelation, has to, in the name of God, call Caesar into faithfulness. And know us to do good, whether it's with the single individual or the corporate group of Christians, and do it at not to him or to them of his friends. We have to champion the people's cause, the people as they're trying to find
their rightful place in God is to give them everything God intended for them, is to stand with them, to help those people who have unjustified fears, like, oh, if you let one in here, they'll take over the congregation, and my daughter will marry them, and the whole family will fall apart. If people have unjustified fears, and many of them have many unjustified fears, you don't put them down and say, oh, you're out of the good. People who have unjustified fears have nonetheless real fears, and they must be helped in life. I'm told that someone's waiting outside here with a baseball bat with, you know, and has an ugly look on his face. I know he is. You know, that's not me. I know you say, someone wants me to play for the country of Cardinals next year. I know that can't be it. And the father, I said, well, maybe someone wants me to, you know, speak at a testimonial banquet for a little league team. That's hardly like it either. But the more I think about it, the more I worry about it. And then I may do some very stupid things, because if my fear, though unjustified, there may be no one out there, maybe be somebody waiting for somebody else to play ball with, but if I really fear that somebody's going to hurt me out there, I may do some awful strange things. You know, if there's not an exit in this building, I may just call up my wife and say, I like it here, and we'll spend the whole week. But, or I may walk to the door where someone quickly pushed him out first, you know. Or I might just take a baseball bat of my own, just swing. But you see, when I'm full of fear, whether that fear is justified or not, I may do some awful things, and it's real, and I'm going to deal with people. And that's why Christian people, when they're scared, often do some awful things, and they need help. They don't need to be put down. But they can't be permitted to be forever fearful. It's pampering a child to let him sleep with a flashlight until he's 23, because he's afraid of the dark. Now then, there are other people who have real fear. After I read in the Chicago paper about policemen coming in and taking Fred Hampton as they did, where all the gunfire is in one direction, and they say they were shooting in self-defense, and then they finally come up with a picture to show a nail, or to show a bullet hole coming from the other side, it's revealed to be a nail hole, then I get worried. I wonder whether in Valparaiso, Indiana, where I am, if word got out that one of our black students had raped the white woman, whether there's any truth to it or not, if I could count on our police not to go to the suspect's room and go in shooting if they had any kind of fear that he's sitting in their arms, without giving him trial or anything. That's the way it is in America with many blacks. And they're really scared, and you don't say it's unjustified. You do everything you can to take away that which makes their fear real. And I don't see Christian folk about to do this with any great deal of dedication. And this is a thing that is still undone. The last word. The Lutheran Church, most full-blown churches, Catholic and Protestant, have not done a very good job of welcoming blacks into the church. That isn't only because we haven't been very good in evangelism, but simply because we have not had a very credible gospel. We have taught the good word of love. John has always told us there is not love in word and speech, but in deed and in truth. Somehow or other, we're going to have to find ways of expressing, not just through an occasional pastor or through an occasional walk down to the public house, but through our congregations standing up and in their lives saying, we care. Because as long as things happen that make people say, I don't think I can trust the message that I know that that church is speaking, then we've got a problem. And Paul says, who is Paul, the stumble, and I blame them?
when we finally become indignant, especially when the frigid indifference of church and church people has caused other people to stumble and to turn away from the faith and the message. If we do not become indignant, nothing's going to happen. If someone tells me that the children in Valparaiso are being inoculated because there's a possibility that there may be a grave epidemic that's taking my students, I'm going to be pretty happy about that inoculation because I got my students. But if I could hear while I'm standing here that the doctors will not permit inoculation of the children here in my school in Valparaiso, I have a ninth grader and I'll break off right here and go home as fast as I can to do something about it. That causes me to be indignant, not only intellectual bit, but an emotional conditioning. I've lived with my child and I love him. And I'm going to see to it that something happens. Unless we really condition our people or give them some traumatic experiences to be aware, as you might have happened to you last night, I hope, and some of the friends, enough to grind away at you and say, we can't let this thing go on. And unless you become indignant, it's going to be the same old thing for a long time, and we don't have time. If one thing is clear, my theology, it is redeem the time because the days are evil. Get rid of the word evil and say, deadly. And you and I, who are out in the name of Jesus Christ, have been sent by him as he was sent. I am come that men may have life and have it more abundantly. Even though this means that I give my life, so men might have life. Thank you. Because our Christian church is synonymous with church. And if you really understand that statement, you don't have to worry too much about what am I going to do about all these things. You are the church. My young daughter, I'm skipping a minute, but my young daughter has been picked out of school 3 times now and all types of jobs. So whatever you might guess, socialization. It didn't drive a train. She's a threat to her friends in the high school to a great extent, and also to her principal, teachers, and so forth. And the other day, I try to stay away from her because I don't want to push at all. The other day, she was sort of pleading for where can I go to make some money this summer. You know, I sensed that she wanted to get out of that forever. If she could hardly take it there, I can understand why. Nobody, she's a sucker girl. She's not allowed to be dated by a young man in high school and this and that. Party's not invited for political reasons and so forth. And I can understand that. I'm trying to say something matter. And it's hard, it's really hard. I want her to get out if she has to get out. It's high time that we allow people to feel. Not as the heart of the matter, but to feel something different. And so I want her to get out. I want to wean her as fast as I can. But at the same time, I hate to pass up opportunities, whether it's now or with her or myself or anywhere. It's not someday, it's none. The people that are put in front of her each day in high school, if she can't find or begin to find joy in not being seen right now, You'll never find it green and earth and someday. Perfect.